Welcome, 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 housers, to another episode of On the Way Home, where we talk about all things housing and homelessness and health and poverty reduction and much, much more. I am your host, Michael Braithwaite. I am very proud to be part of the team at Blue Door, an organization that operates just north of Toronto in York Region, Durham Region, and Peel Region. And we do all sorts of neat things. Today, I want to tell you about Construct, our construction social enterprise. You know, for a long time, we were doing these really cool employment programs where we work with vulnerable people through barriers. We put them into jobs and they'd kind of move forward. But it was frustrating them too. A lot of the jobs we put them into maybe didn't have a lot of purpose or really didn't get them excited. And it definitely didn't pay them a living wage. So they were getting frustrated. We were breaking that cycle of poverty. But then as we do across this country, there's some people who are willing to share. My good friend, Mark Sobrano, at Building Up in Toronto, who learned he has Building Up, and Building Up was, looked at Choices for Youth program. Sheldon Paul and his team out in Newfoundland and Purpose Built, our Purpose Construction in Manitoba, and the work they were doing there, and they all learned from each other, and they were willing to share with us on the north of Toronto, and we came up with Construct, and it's a social purpose construction training program. And we were lucky enough to work with Luna 506, a construction union, and they said, hey, we'll do some of the training if you run the program. We run this program. It's 8 weeks. People come into it. They get paid. They get their transportation taken care of. If they need rent supports, they get that. If they need mental health supports, they get that. We work on getting them their license. If they need childcare supports, we get that. And we launch them into the trades. They get some certifications. They get some site experience to figure out if this is what they want to do. They get all sorts of information with all sorts of different trades. And then they go on to be apprentices. And then that's $21 to $25 an hour. Or to $28 an hour, depending on the trade, and which coincidentally is a living wage, breaks the cycle of poverty, the purpose. It's incredible. To date, we put 400 people into the trades with our amazing partners. And if they say, hey, this isn't for me, we work with our friends at the YMCA of Greater Toronto, who then place them in a different job. So it's a win-win-win. And guess what? There's another part to it. We are a full-scale construction company. So we have experts that do work. So if you're to hire Blue Door for your commercial property or to do a build, we come in and you pay, competitive pricing, you have high quality work. What you don't pay for is the social good, because depending on the size of the project, you can have 10 to 50 people who actually get work experience on that site and go into the trade. So you're part of the solution. Listen, one of the reasons we don't have the housing we need is because we don't have the people to build the housing we need. So it solves that too. And when we do work, that revenue comes back into Blue Door, and that is non-government revenue, so we can buy housing, build housing, add to programs, add to services. It's just a win all around. That program is called Construct. Check out that and all the different housing and health programs we do at bluedoor.ca. And we run that program in York Region. We run it in partnership with Durham College in Durham and with Humber College in Peel. Very, very cool. Check it out, bluedoor.ca. Let's talk about today's guest. We hear a lot about supply. We need to build to get out of this housing crisis. Absolutely true. We need to build. We also need to focus on building a lot of affordable housing. And we need to do that. But you know what? For every new build, we're losing all sorts of existing housing, existable affordable housing to private landlords. Buying it up is the financialization of housing. They're making money, but they're putting rents up, and we're losing that housing. So we're never going to keep up if we just build new. We have to find a way of acquiring housing. Well, the good folks in BC, and they're usually ahead of us, ahead of the curve on this, they're already running something. They have the Rental Protection Fund. And today we're joined by their CEO, Katie Maslechko. And as well, along with her, we have the wonderful Ray Sullivan from CHRA. Why are they together? Well, they're doing this already. They have this acquisition fund in the province of BC. And Katie comes on and we talk a lot about how that's worked, the rollout, that they've surpassed their targets. It's been incredible, the buy-in to that and how it's rolling out. And then we talk about that need to do that nationally. And Ray talks about some of the work that CHRA has done about this and how we've been talking about it for years. But CHRA and the Rental Protection Fund and others have come together There's four partners, and they've approached the federal government and said, and they formed this coalition. It's called Canadian Housing AF, a fun name. And they've come together and they have pushed the government, I think it was for $2.5 billion. We talked about that. We talked about the outcomes they're expected from that, both low interest loans and contributions. So nonprofits go out and purchase and acquire homes and keep them affordable. And they're looking at 10,000 units over 2 years. It's incredible work. They have the ear of government. They're hoping for April 16th budget that they'll get the go ahead and to roll this out quick. They know how to do it because they have the experience of the rental fund in BC. It's a wonderful conversation with Katie and Ray. We talk about the need. We talk about how it's going to work. We learn about their work that they're already doing. And you find out how you can get involved. There's a website you can go to so you can support this, put pressure on the government to actually do something around acquisitions. And we really, really hope they will. A great conversation, a necessary conversation, exciting times. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Let's go to that now. Katie and Ray, so glad to have you on the podcast this week. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having us, great. Michael. Great to be here.
Yeah, really great to be here.
I don't know why I'm saying us either. You're joining me, really. There's no one else here. No surprises.
You and the podcast are often joining me when I'm washing dishes. So now it's nice to be part of this side of the microphone.
Perfect. And feel free to wash dishes while we do this as well, right? You can multitask if you want. And while you're thinking about that, I want you to think about this. And Ray, I think you've had the chance to answer this before. So we're going to let Katie go first. We have a traditional first question on the podcast, and that is, what does home mean to you? There's no right or wrong answer, but there are better ones. Katie?
I was thinking about this one as well. I think, first and foremost, it's a foundation, literally and figuratively, but I also think home is potential. It's a place where so many things are built upon, incubated, and depending on your kind of ability to build upon something that is stable, when it comes to your housing, so does your kind of ability to achieve it. But I think it's also where we dream up a lot of those potential dreams and then go off into the world out the front door every morning and hopefully make them happen.
Amazing answer. Great answer. And we've never had potential before. So I love that. No pressure, Ray, for that. And we're going to go to you for what does home mean to you?
Yeah. And I love that idea of stability, Katie. And I've been thinking a lot about security and safety. I don't mean like the physical safety and security of having a solid door that you can lock behind you, but the emotional and the mental safety and security of a place where you can be yourself, you can relax and you can feel really good about where you are. And I want to tell you a story because, my connection to the community housing world actually comes from my own home. And my first connection to community housing was as a tenant. Back in the late 1990s, my partner and I think we'd calculated that in the previous decade, we'd had about 12 different addresses that we'd lived in multiple cities and mostly in Ottawa. And a friend recommended us to CCOC, Centretown Citizens Ottawa Corporation, a private nonprofit here in the Ottawa area. And we saw this fantastic townhome. We moved in and we just felt safe. We knew that our rent was going towards something that we believed in. We knew that our values were aligned with where we were living. We knew that our rent wasn't just helping some guy buy a new fishing boat, and it was contributing to the community. And that really gave me a safety and a security and a peace in knowing I'd found the right place to make my home.
Thank you so much for sharing, Ray. That's an awesome story. And you're so right. I mean, really, if that's not settled, if you don't have that home or that base, nothing in life really makes sense, right? It scatters mm-hmm. families, working, your mental health. You just need that security. And certainly all those pieces you mentioned are very relevant to the conversation we're going to have today. Let's talk a little bit about your journeys into this sector. Ray, we're going to start with you and then we'll go over to Katie. If you just tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah. So, a couple of months after renting that place from CCOC, one of my neighbors came over and delivered a newsletter to my front door where I was sitting on the step enjoying the spring weather. And there was an ad on the back for a job with the landlord, with CCOC. And I was slowly dropping out of grad school at the time and didn't really have steady work. And I started thinking, oh, I could actually do some of these things. And wouldn't you know it, my wife was upstairs reading the newspaper, seeing the exact same ad in the Ottawa Citizen. She came downstairs to the front porch and lovingly gave me a kick in the pants and said, hey, here's a job that you could probably do. Why don't you go get a job? And so I did, and started working in nonprofit housing in the late 1990s, and really fell in love with the work that I was doing, the connection to community, you know, and worked for over 20 years for CCOC. And I remember talking to new staff when they came in, you know, the relationships that we're building with tenants might be relationships that you have for 10, 15, and 20 years. It's closer to a family relationship than a client, you know, service kind of thing. And, you know, the breadth of the work in, you're dealing with community organizing, you're dealing with health, you're dealing with social services, you're dealing with planning, you're dealing with construction, you're dealing with urban issues. It had everything that I needed to fulfill me in my life. I'm very, very proud to have been a part of the community housing sector for a while now.
Thanks, Ray. Katie, will, and of course, now ending up at CHRA.
Yes. Yeah, for the past year and a half, I'm the lucky person who gets to be the executive director of CHRA, the Canadian Housing and Renewal Association. So we're the association that represents community housing from coast to coast to coast across Canada.
Wonderful. And we're going to hear more about CHRA as well. Katie, tell me a little bit about your journey into the work.
Yeah, I think the entire sector is fortunate that Ray did end up at CHRA after all of that. For me, I would say my journey probably began with fascination with the concept of urbanness, urban living. Growing up in Calgary, that was not necessarily what I was, you know, most familiar with, but really was drawn to in terms of kind of the mix of uses and vibrancy and things like that. Thought I wanted to be a planner originally, realized there was this place called real estate where it seemed like an even more fun version of planning in terms of having the same kind of impact on your city or community and that legacy and shaping it. But that like it was your job to kind of, you know, push the boundaries and, you know, maybe not break the rules, but like see what you could do within them and how creative you could get. And that really kind of resonated with me. I started my career in traditional condo development, but very quickly became kind of affectionately referred to as the special projects person. So still a little bit of condo, but a lot of other interesting, unique things as well. A lot of our partnership work, I was at BD through this time, including all of our affordable housing projects that we were working on then, got to do the first retail application of Mass Timber for Mountain Equipment Co-op at the time. Which is their Vancouver flagship store. And then also the first two kind of new development life sciences buildings that have really started to foster Vancouver's life sciences ecosystem and in partnership with a group called Abcelera out there. So yeah, always these really interesting projects, great partners all along the way. Always had a real passion for the affordable housing projects in particular. I did spend a bit of time as well working in New York City for a nonprofit real estate developer out there who also was financing as well. They distributed low market tax credits. And we would actually help charter schools build schools in kind of the five borough area where they get chartered. They've got about 3 months and then they have to open a school. So it was often finding them a temporary space and then creating a long-term development plan for them to have a permanent school space out there and really being exposed to some of the, you know, really unique and interesting, in particular, financing models that do exist down in the States. Tax credits being one of them, and certainly acquisition preservation being another, and then ultimately landed back in Vancouver a few years later, have ended up, I'm coming up on about a year almost since joining the Rental Protection Fund in BC as its CEO.
Very cool. And on that, that's a great segue. I want you to tell me a little bit more about the organization. What's its purpose? How did it all come about?
Absolutely. So the Rental Protection Fund has also been around just about a year as of the end of this month. And we were established with an initial contribution of $500 million from the province of BC. And we exist to effectively fill the equity gap that naturally exists that allows nonprofits to then purchase existing rental buildings. So rental buildings that are already there, that are often, you know, well, frankly, are the ones that were built the last time the federal government was investing in housing and have been operating since, often well below market. Not because they've been legislated that way, but simply just due to their age and some really well-intentioned landlords, but that are in a place where, you know, they are looking to be sold and they could be sold to a private sector investor of any sort, or they could move into the community housing sector. And that's really what we're out here to do. And it's about more than just helping them bridge that equity gap, which is inherently what allows those rents to stay affordable, but really about moving those assets and that equity into the hands of the community housing sector, because they can then leverage that far beyond the property lines of that particular building or that particular asset and really impact all of their work and ultimately creating bigger or more actors in the supply side of the equation as well, too, by doing so.
Wow, wonderful work. And what is the uptick like so far? So good, or how's it going so far? I know it has been a long time, but.
Yeah, well, so far, really, really good in the sense that we have been absolutely blown away with the demand that we've seen and the way that the community housing sector has stepped up. We launched applications back in July of last summer, and by September, we had pre-qualified our first kind of 25 or 30 nonprofit organizations. And by December, we started bringing forward the first official acquisitions for consideration. But even just by the fall, having opened the applications in July, we already had a pipeline at that time that was 1,200 units deep, and at this point is well past 2,000 units deep. And when we were established, I mean, we have a mandate of $500 million to secure 2,000 units over 3 years. So not only are we well on our way to exceeding that goal in terms of time, but we're also seeing the community housing sector really get creative and strategic in the properties that they're finding and seeking to acquire. And what that's also allowing us to do is overperform on that 2,000 unit target as well, regardless of how quickly we may achieve it, because we're able to stretch every dollar that much further. And that is largely in credit to the community housing sector and the way that they're going about it and getting creative. We've also already had some social impact investors also step up and play an important role in these acquisitions. And again, stretching that dollar that much further.
And I don't know if you thought of this, maybe we could talk about this after. Maybe it's an idea that could grow federally. But before we get to that, We're going to go to Mr. Sullivan to talk about CHRA. Tell us a little bit about, for those who might be living under a rock, what does CHRA do and what are you focused on?
Yeah, and I'm definitely on the same page about replicating what Katie's doing in BC at a federal level. So, and that's where CHRA operates. We are at the federal level, the voice of the community housing sector. We've been around since slightly longer than I've been around in 1968. And, you know, what's really exciting, and this is something that has always motivated me in career, is pushing for systemic change. You know, the kinds of need that we see, the kinds of failures that we see in our system are not things that can be fixed with Band-Aid. We need broader systemic change. And that's the mission of CHRA, is to advocate for systemic change toward the right to housing for everyone in the country. We're a membership-based organization. And, you know, at the core of our members are co-op, nonprofit, and public housing providers, the community housing sector, but also municipalities, provincial governments, advocacy organizations, service-based organizations, and even individuals who support the mission and want to be a part of what it is that we're doing. At the core of our work is the premise that we need to more than double the share of community housing within Canada. You know, we're at like a measly about 4% of all homes are community housing homes in the country. That's less than half of the OECD average. It's actually less than the United States, for goodness sakes. And it's less than it was historically in Canada. You know, we were closer to 7 or 8% of the housing share in the early 1990s, when 15 to 20% of all housing starts were co-ops and nonprofits and public housing homes. And look at where that's got us as we backed off on those kinds of targets. You know, look at the mess that we're in now by not having enough community housing. So this is what we're all about at CHRA. We're an advocacy organization, we're a service-based organization, we're an education organization. We also administer the Chartered Institute of Housing Canada, so the professional certification body for community housing in the country. We've got great mentorship programs, and the next round of our mentorship program is launching in a little while. So any listeners on the podcast, if you are experienced veterans in the community housing world, we need you to help bring up the next generation of leaders along with us. So yeah, folks who support that mission, folks who want to be a part of what we're doing, we invite you to join us and be a part of CHRA.
And as someone who has been a part of that, Ray, I could tell people, you want to do this. You want to be a mentor. You're going to learn. You're going to get way more out of it almost than the person being mentored, because there's some wonderful young leaders that will maybe reignite that passion you have as well. So I encourage people to get involved both as a mentor or if you want, or you're looking for someone to mentor you, you're an upcoming leader in this. CHRA has the ear of government, and quite often they are the voice for the sector, and it's so appreciated. You've got some important messages in the ears of the right people. You continue to do that. We have a upcoming budget coming up. We're going to talk more about that. Now, you've both talked a little bit about the need for deeply affordable supply, and we keep hearing build. That's great. We need to build new, and no one's going to argue that. But you know, that other missing part of the equation is that, and I've heard numbers all over the place, depending on who I talk to, from, you know, it's for every new build, we lose 7 to 10 to 15 to 20 to, and I guess it depends what's in there, but it's crumbling infrastructure, private sector buying up, no longer affordable, that kind of thing. So we definitely need to do exactly what Katie was talking about in BC. And you know, we have to have access to these mechanisms to acquire and keep buildings affordable, deeply affordable in perpetuity, right? And I think that's what we're talking about today. And we want to talk about, now it's called the Canadian Housing Acquisition Fund, or CHAF. And I think you're going to tell me some new news around that. But how did CHAF come about, and why is it important?
First, let's not go with the acronym CHAF. It doesn't sound great. We want to rise above that. What we're going with is Canadian Housing AF.
Okay.
And what we're trying to do is fill in one of the big blind spots in the national housing strategy, which is very focused on supply. And look, we need more housing supply, and specifically we need more supply and more new builds of community housing. No questions asked. But you know, you've had Steve Pomeroy on the podcast before, and he's really pioneered a lot of this research in looking at the loss of existing private market rental housing that is already at the affordable level. You know, so for every one new affordable home we're creating through national housing strategy programs, we're losing 11 in the private market. So you know, maybe it's absolute loss, but more likely it's just those rents aren't affordable in the same way anymore. And this is one of the dynamics that we know is happening in the multifamily real estate market right now. One, the properties are valued not based on the current rental income, but on the potential rent income. And you see this in listings, right? The listing agent will say, plenty of uplift capacity in this building. That means that the rents are affordable. And if you could just displace those annoying tenants who are living there now, you can double that rent and improve your income.
Yeah. Well, we had an announcement just the other week that was literally the headline that was written about that exact property about a year ago was, this one's a gold mine if you can just kick out the tenants. And less than a year later, we were able to move that one into the hands of an Indigenous-led nonprofit.
Oh, so that's great. No, but that's exactly the work that's inspiring us, the work that you're doing in BC. So those tenants now have safety and protection, the things that are so important in the home. And as important, those rents are stabilized now. So those rents are not going to double when people move out.
Right.
And part of this dynamic is when a new owner, and I'm not saying this applies to all owners, but it applies to enough of them that it's making a big impact in people's lives. When they see someone who's, you know, probably one of the longer standing tenants in that building, maybe they've lived there for 15 or even 20 years, and they're paying $800 for that one bedroom apartment. Well, guess what, Grandma? You know, you've enjoyed living there for a long time, but if that landlord can figure out a way to kick you out, then they can triple that rent, you know, to 21. I didn't do the math right there, but over $2,000 each month. And we're seeing this happening in the private market, and that's the loss of the existing supply of affordable market housing. And there's all kinds of mechanisms that are employed for this. You know, suddenly up pops a letter saying, well, my own daughter wants to move into that apartment, so I'm afraid you've got your couple months notice and you've got to go. And 3 months later, what happens? That apartment is listed, you know, for double or triple the rent than it was before. Or we've got to renew the bathroom, you know, so You can't live there while we're renewing the bathroom. Great. Landlord puts $5,000 into the washroom, and that's great. You know, that's work and repair work that needs to happen. But then they relist it for a new tenant and, you know, for $1,000 more every month, and they've recovered that investment pretty quickly. So how do we protect those tenants who are at risk every time a multifamily building, an apartment building, turns hands in the private market? And how do we make
Construct, a social enterprise by Bluedoor, provides high-quality residential and commercial construction and property services in the Greater Toronto Area. More than a business with a heart, Construct is a real solution to preventing and ending homelessness. Through its 8-week paid skills trades training program, complete with wraparound supports and on-the-job work experience, Construct lifts people out of poverty and into opportunity. To hire Construct for your next project, or learn more about Construct's employment program, visit constructgta.ca.
Make sure that those rents are stabilized and don't skyrocket like we've been seeing over the past few years. So this is what Katie's doing in BC, and this is what we want to do at the national level.
And let's face it, right? More and more people are going to be renting than buying. Buying is just not an option for so many. But why does it have to be such a scary option, Ray, as you mentioned? And full disclosure, interesting enough, we've been in the same place, my family and I. We rent in Toronto, and we've been renting for 7 years in this place, right? And rents have not. And we've got my son's getting married, he's going to move in. I'm pretty sure it's a lie, right? But you kind of always live on the edge as a renter, thinking, at what point are they going to kick us out or do, you know, and so where do we go next? And so we're looking at, and listen, you know, from a point of privilege, we're fortunate enough to be able to go out and pay market rents, but we're looking at a huge, for the same place, he's going to turn around and do probably about a 40% increase on what we're paying here, right? And that's what's probably driving it, to your point. So absolutely, we need to keep, you know, as many buildings and affordability and get them in there. How did this come about? There's a group that's come together. We're going to talk about the partners, but we've been hearing about this for a long time, the need for acquisition. So how did you guys come together? How did it happen? Have you had discussions with government? Did they kind of push you this way, or you know, give me some history.
So it's been a lot of work over the past couple of years. You know, the sector, the community housing sector as a whole, has been pointing out this blind spot in the national housing strategy for many years now. But over the past year and a half or so, we've really made inroads in getting CMHC and the government to recognize that this is also a hole in the national housing strategy. So there's been great interest, and we really appreciate and can see and feel the consensus, you know, at round tables, at policy consultations, that people think acquisitions is an important part of the solutions. But once we had government's attention, they were like, okay, so now what? What does it look like? How do you put it on the ground? And that's where we took a lot of inspiration from the Rental Protection Fund in BC, both in the concept of what we were doing, in the governance and the way we set it up, but also in the things that Katie was also trying to put in place to build on where they started from at BC. So maybe you can tell that story, Katie, about how things were set up, and we can talk about how we're replicating it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that I see the national fund that we've kind of created, it is an expansion of the way that we're structured in BC in a number of ways, because one of the things that the community housing sector in the province really, you know, showed some great leadership on in how they established the fund was by putting it truly in the hands of the community housing sector. So we ourselves are not a crown corporation. We are not an agency of government. We are established as a completely independent, arm's length nonprofit. My board is comprised of the CEOs of the BC Nonprofit Housing Association, the Aboriginal Housing Management Association, and the Co-op Housing Federation of BC, who together have formed the Housing Central Coalition as well, and really been pushing for an acquisition strategy both in BC and alongside Ray and others for many, many years. And the province really recognized that if they were going to make this investment, that perhaps it really was best served by being in the hands of those who know the sector best and the realities on the ground, and that that we would be equipped to deliver it more directly and efficiently and quickly the way that it's needed, and really credit them with taking that on and seeing that. They are, like, BC is leading by example right now on a lot of things when it comes to housing. Credit to them for that. And the Rental Protection Fund, we recognize that hopefully we are, you know, serving as some sort of pilot or model that other provinces will already want to replicate, and better yet, that the federal government will step up and play an active role in. And I'll tell you, I mean, I have had a call with nearly every province at this point, many calls with a number of them. We're certainly not the only ones. We're obviously doing more than thinking about it, but there's lots of other provinces across the country who are actively exploring this and asking really, really good questions. And I think that if there were to be participation at a federal level in terms of unlocking some of those pieces that, you know, only government can, or in quite the same way that only government can, it would really catalyze, I think, some of those who are already almost there to really step up and run with it, and those who aren't to find a way to get there so that they can play a role in all of this. Because ultimately, when it comes to acquisitions, and as Ray was kind of alluding to earlier, with these properties, because the borrowing capacity is directly linked to the rents, everyone ends up with an equity gap, no matter whether you are a private sector. Equity gap can be overcome by jacking up the rents, as we've spoken about, or it can be overcome by a combination of, you know, whether it's grants or, in our case, capital contribution, equity style funds that can bridge part of that gap, and access to lower cost financing that has greater kind of borrowing capacity. And that's where the federal government can play a really, really meaningful role, is giving the community housing sector access to those low-cost borrowing terms and make this that much more viable for everyone. Otherwise, the inherent pressure is always going to be on the rents in order to fill that gap.
So over the past 6 months, it's been a job of coalition building. You know, we'd established the consensus that there needs to be something around acquisition. Then it was, well, what is that something? So we've been putting a lot of work into pulling together folks from the community housing side, from municipal governments, from the private sector as well, to figure out what exactly that model is and what impact can it make. So what we've come around to is a combination of very low interest loans, you know, and the lower the interest rate on the loan, the less that equity gap is that Katie was talking about, supplemented by government contributions, by grants to fill part of that gap, but also stacking on top of that private capital as impact investment. So maybe it's philanthropic foundations, financial institutions who want to give back and make those kinds of social impact investments into the community. And there's quite a bit of interest in that space. And Katie and her team have been really mining and exploring that. And then when it came to setting an actual organization up, which we did in December, we took inspiration again from the BC Rental Protection Fund. So there are four members of the corporation, and the board is made up of those four. It's the Co-op Housing Federation of Canada, ourselves at CHRA, NICHI, the National Indigenous Collaborative Housing Inc. And well, we had to bring Katie and the team at the Rental Protection Fund on board because they've got the real world tested experience in setting one of these things up. And we've benefited enormously from that decision as well.
Well, and that time is of the essence too, you know, that these assets are at risk of disinvestment. They're old, but ready to be renewed and purchased and moved into the sector. And if us being at the table can position the fund to move that much more quickly and be ready to partner with government if they were to step up, then that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, and we talk about, I think, what is it now? How many homes? Like, is it 5 million total? Like 3 million plus? Or that we they're looking for 2030. There's no way you're going to build where we're not even, you know, building half of what we need each year. And so this helps keep, you know, some new affordability or adds more affordability onto it. The program Mira in Toronto too. You see it on a municipal level, right? Them doing that, and that's certainly been a huge help. I love what you're talking about. You got proof of concept. You say, how's it done? Hey, here's how it's done. We're doing it already, and we've got learnings, and we can, you know, it transfers federally beautifully. We've got partners, and I like what you're saying too, because I mean, not to slag government, but when government takes ownership of a program and rolls it out, it's not fast, as Katie pointed out. There's too many layers, too complicated. I think CMHC friends would be the first to tell you that. It just gets, it takes a while. We look at even the Housing Acquisition Fund, from we're going to do this to rolling out dollars has taken a long time, longer than they thought, right? So this is, and we look at what you've done in BC, I mean, that's quick. You moved quick, you moved mountains fast. And the hope, I guess, is talk to me about some of the numbers, right? You've said you put in an ask for the budget, which is going to be released on April 16th. What have you asked for, and what does that mean? If you get that amount, what are some of the outcomes that you're looking for?
Katie and I are wondering who's going to go first on this. So what we've modeled out is the impact that we can make with $2.5 billion in low interest loans, $500 million in contributions, and we think we can raise in social impact capital another $400 to $600 million. Over a pretty short space, that means that we can secure and protect about 10,000 tenancies across the country. I think that's a two-year timeline. And this is one of the things that folks in government and folks outside of government started asking us as we were working up toward this proposals. You know, do you really think that there's a pipeline available? And are there enough nonprofits who would step up to do acquisitions? And, you know, my answer was always, I was puzzled because it's like, well, all of those nonprofits and co-ops that are doing new development, which is way riskier, way harder, and requires even more skin in the game, they are definitely ready to do acquisitions, plus that many more, because it's quicker, it's less risky, and it's simpler. And if there's one thing that we know how to do, unfortunately, in the community housing world, it's how to manage old buildings. that we've got locked down. But yeah. What they've seen in BC is that pipeline is actually bigger, I think, than was originally expected.
And yeah, I mean, we were originally conceptualized as, you know, doing about 700 units a year in order to achieve that mandate. And I think we all thought there would maybe be, you know, 20 maybe nonprofits who would step up and want to be a part of it. And we are, again, barely 6 months since opening applications, and we've already pre-qualified, I believe, about 35, but we have 90 applications total. Some of them still working their way through, some of them under consideration by us. So 90 nonprofits across the province who are interested in playing a role in expanding their own capacity this way. And of course, well exceeding that 700 unit target with our 2000 plus unit deep pipeline. So I do think that 10,000 unit in 2 years is very achievable. And those are very real, you know, properties and assets that could be moved into the community housing sector, and that those assets are moving that much more quickly into the sector, and that the sector's capacity is expanding substantially as a result, which we need to do.
And I want to talk about some of the broader impacts on this as well. And we know the impacts on the folks who are at risk when their property changes ownership, and people who are being rent evicted and losing their homes or experiencing those rapid rent increases. But there's a bigger economic impact that everyone in Canada benefits from as well. And along with Housing Partnership Canada and a couple of our other partners, CHRA released a report at the end of last November on asking ourselves, what is the impact on productivity, on GDP per capita, which if you read business papers is all that people are talking about in the past couple of weeks, if we were to increase the supply of community housing. So we engaged Deloitte Canada, and the brilliant economists there crunched the numbers for us, and they calculated what the impact would be if we raised the share of community housing within Canada's housing stock by just like 1.5%. So not a monumental shift, not the more than doubling that we're actually calling for, but a significant enough growth. And the results were actually surprised the economists. You know, they were seeing that it would lead to an increase in productivity of between 5.7 and 9.3% every year. And I'm not an economist, right? So when they came out with that preliminary result, I was like, is that good? Is that a lot? They go, oh, that's huge. Like for one sector of the economy to have that kind of impact on GDP per capita was huge. But not only that, you know, it adds... But what was it? $67 to $130 billion to the economy every year. And that's not, you know, the economic impact of the construction and the building. That's improvements to the economic efficiency of just having more people living with affordable rents under community housing. You know, people who are more mobile in terms of their work options, people who are able to save more or even spend more in their local economy rather than everything going to their landlord, people who are able to go back to school and improve their skills in the workplace. All of these things come together to make the economy more efficient. And because it makes the economy more efficient and you have these returns on that investment, it's inflation free. So we're talking about adding that kind of economic impact without triggering any kind of inflation to the economy. And I did the math because I like to pull out my calculator and crunch the numbers every now and then, and calculated the cost of what it would take to build that much more community housing to get us up another 1.5%. And the payback period for that upfront cost is less than 2 years in terms of positive return to the economy. So, you know, acquisitions is one of the ways of increasing the supply of community housing in our communities and in our economies. We need to do new development. We also need to do acquisitions. And because it benefits productivity, that benefits quality of life for everyone in Canada, and everybody in our communities benefits.
Yeah. Community assets build community wealth.
Well said. Look at that. She summed it up just like that. And so you put this forward to government. What is the reception? What have you heard so far? Are they eager? Was it a good reception? Are you feeling pretty good about this upcoming budget? I mean, never any guarantees, but what have you heard?
Yeah, never any guarantees, but we are expecting the federal government to take action through the next budget. And we've seen the increased recognition that they need to fill in this blind spot in the national housing strategy. And you know, our intention through all of this is to be one step ahead of the government so that we're ready when they're ready to invest. So we've set up the corporation. We're learning the operational lessons from BC. We're building that partnership, reaching out to potential impact investors so that when government is ready to take the next step, we're ready to take the next two steps with them.
And we certainly hope that they do, because at least speaking from a BC Rental Protection Fund perspective, I mean, we've got just shy of 2,000 units that have already moved out of the speculative market, but are at very real risk of not being able to stay that way, and potentially having to return back to the market, and these nonprofits no longer be able to actually successfully acquire them. And so we really do hope that that the feds are able to step up and play a role so that that doesn't happen.
So let's look forward. April 16th rolls around. They say, we love it. Here's your full ask. What happens after that?
Katie, you've actually gone through this in BC, so go for it.
Well, I mean, speaking for our properties, we have a number of them that are due to close. And while we're working to find ways to make sure that they're able to successfully do that, no matter what, hopefully, you know, what it could end up meaning is if it weren't to play a role, if it weren't to be in the budget, that our dollar would definitely not go as far. Some of those units we will not be able to secure, and others it'll mean that BC has to, you know, or the fund has to step up and bridge a gap we wouldn't have otherwise. And that will directly affect our ability to secure those units. If it does find its way into the budget, I mean, just looking at our portfolio alone, it's the difference between right now we're on track to secure at least 2,500 to 3,000 units. And depending on how the federal government may be able to step up and play a role, it could be the difference between 2,500 units and 10,000 units or more, with the $500 million that BC has stepped up to the table with. And if you extrapolate, you know, that nationwide, the impact is significant. And I think the way that we've also structured the fund and the proposal to government is also so that it can move quickly and efficiently and be ready to start deploying those funds and start to secure those 10,000 units as quickly as possible.
And we know that what we're doing has to move quickly. You know, it has to move at the actual speed of the actual marketplace. Can't imagine a scenario where an apartment building comes up and you put down an offer and say to the vendor, yep, I'll have your money for you in 12 to 18 months. And, you know, and if that's how long it takes to go through a government-based application and government machinery process to go through it, well, that vendor's just going to say, sorry, see ya. I've got five other people lined up behind you who are interested in this. So this is why it's important that it's a community-based, a sector-based entity that is supporting these acquisitions so that we can get around some of those obstacles and move quickly. It's also why there'd be a pre-approval process. So much like people who are searching to buy their own private home might get pre-approved by their bank for a mortgage of a certain size or within certain boundaries, nonprofits and co-ops would be able to come to the Canadian Housing Acquisition Fund, get pre-approved for a certain size of building, a certain amount of mortgage and loan, whatever it is within those parameters. And then when they can propose an actual building, it moves that much quicker down the line. But this is also why ideally the loan facility, the mortgage that they'd be accessing, would be coming from a community-based entity rather than through a larger government entity that's not able to move as quickly and responsibly as we would in the community. And that's a really key thing.
Yeah, and it's also key in terms of attracting and retaining the interest of that private capital that truly and genuinely wants to be playing a meaningful role. But they need and deserve stability and predictability just like anyone else. The kind of federal debt being predictable and stable can offer that and make it possible for every dollar to go that much further and for us to really leverage hand in hand all together to achieve this impact.
And from the work we've done in the past year, you know, there are impact investors who've already helped some land trusts and some nonprofits with these kinds of acquisitions. And what they said to us is, we want something aggregated at a national scale rather than doing these one-off kind of transactions. But we've also heard from real estate owners who are like, I think I want to sell this apartment building. I would really rather sell it to a nonprofit or a co-op because I think that that would be a better outcome for the folks who live there and for the community that's in. So we know just from the quiet work that we've been doing over the past year that the interest is there among investors, sellers, and definitely among the community housing providers who want to purchase these properties.
And we've seen
we just need that spark of government investment now.
Yeah, we've seen both over in BC. I mean, just in those that we've already approved or have in our immediate pipeline, we've seen impact investors already step up with over $50 million on those deals so far. Which is incredible. And it's why, you know, ensuring that those deals don't fall apart is really significant because they have stepped up and really led by example. And we don't want to see, you know, that desire fall away, certainly. And so hopefully that can be possible. I really do hope.
And it's, listen, I have no doubt there's going to be a huge response. There's a huge need. I look even in our area of north of Toronto and York, Peel, Durham, there's a nineplex at Aurora that is deeply affordable right now, is on the market. Is someone's going to take it. The uplift, as Ray said earlier, that's what it's being sold on. And when we've gone to local, provincial, we've looked at, hey, someone help us buy this and keep it. Mm-hmm. There's just nothing. Right. And I think it was, have you tried fundraising, was the advice we got as a nonprofit, right? Desperately trying to do that. We've been kind of at Blue Door scraping and clawing, trying to hold on to different assets here and there from reaching home, a donor here and there. And because the private market's just not doing it for our clients deeply, you know, the people who are very, very vulnerable and might have some needs around it, but it's not doing that. So I can tell you that the sector is going to embrace this. If we want to support, as we should, how can we help? How can people support? People listening, organizations listening, how can they get on board to help push this forward?
Contact your member of parliament. Let them know that this is a missing piece in the national housing strategy, but also talk to your municipal governments. Let those mayors know that, you know, they have an opportunity as well if the federal government steps up. You know, a lot of them are the ones left holding the bag when it comes to affordable housing and services and are looking for this kind of support. And you know, provincial and municipal dollars can stretch a lot farther with that federal input, and especially the leveraging the federal borrowing power. You know, the federal government can lend out funds cheaper than any other entity in the country, and we need to use that for this massive public priority in solving and addressing the housing crisis.
Well, and even in their ability, you know, so many municipalities across the country are working really hard to deliver new supply right now. And this is also to ensure that the investments and time and resources and literal dollars that they are investing in that are actually being deployed and leveraged to their full extent, because you're able to retain the supply that already exists so that we're not just pouring dollars, no matter their source, into a bucket with a big giant hole at the bottom. And so it's leveraging that investment of time and funds and resources that's happening already.
So if people want to find out more, if they want to, of course, listen to this podcast, but if they want to find out more information, around that, was it Canadian AF Housing? Is this, did I get that right?
Canadian Housing AF.
Canadian Housing AF. If they want to find out more, is there a website or somewhere they could go to get more information?
Yeah, and they can also tell their friends to listen to this podcast to learn more about it. But yeah, we've got a website, acquisitionfunds.ca, and people can go there, read the full proposal. But as important as that, there's a section on that website where they can show their support and enlist as one of our endorsers and one of our supporters. And you'll see there's a long list of folks in there already. And we want to show the strength and the breadth of support behind this proposal to government.
Yeah, I really do think that breadth is significant. And already with those who have been a part of this to date and signed on to that, really represents a uniquely broad cross-section of sectors and industries looking to see this become real. And as far as the Rental Protection Fund goes specifically, you can find us at rentalprotectionfund.ca.
Now, I noticed too with Rental Protection Fund, you don't have BC in the title. Is that on purpose or is that, you know, so you can have growth? Is there thought of moving that into a different province or maybe?
Well, I suppose it's leaving space for every province to have its own rental protection fund.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
And to partner with a federal acquisition fund to make that happen.
Amazing. And doing amazing work. You're right. BC is just doing some incredible stuff. We actually today, the podcast that was released today, as we record this on March 21st, is with BC Housing. So you can learn all about them. But don't go to that yet. Ray, tell us, this is a shameless plug, CHRA, you got a big conference coming up. What else is going on? Where can people find out more?
Yeah, we definitely do. But before we get to that, Michael, I want to thank you because I heard that it's your 5-year anniversary working for Blue Door. And I wanted to thank you for all the incredible work that you and your team are doing.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Yeah, you know what? This work is really a lot easier when you work with super talented people. And I'm very blessed that I have a lot of people way smarter than me that work with me day in, day out. So it's gone by so quick. And I think we've done some stuff, some good stuff. But like, man, we haven't scratched the surface. There's so much more to do. And unfortunately, you know, and it can get frustrating. You have to look for the small wins, as I'm sure you both do. When you look back, you're like, man, have we moved the needle? A little bit, as much as we wanted? No. Because the need and all these different things that have happened in between. When I started 5 years ago at Blue Door, you know, we weren't thinking COVID. And we weren't thinking of how. And I remember when that started, Nick Falvo came on and he said, listen, you're not really going to feel the real kind of fallout from COVID till 3 years after it's over. And he's right. We're seeing that, right? Like, I mean, as a researcher, he really said, here's where, and our most vulnerable, of course, are going to feel the most. And we're seeing that day in and day out. But we are fortunate that we have CHRA that has the ear of government, that does all sorts of great op-eds. The work with Deloitte you talked about was incredible, just showing, hey, not only will, you know, does this make sense, but like it makes economic sense and so on. But so much work going on. You have Congress coming up in April in beautiful Fredericton, and there's still spots available, right? You can still sign up.
There are just about 2 weeks from the time that this podcast airs, our National Congress on Housing and Homelessness from April 9 to 11 in beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick. They're really rolling out the welcome mat for us. It's going to be fantastic. They've actually arranged a solar eclipse to pass overhead just before the Congress begins to open things up for us. And, you know, we had our first in-person Congress in Winnipeg last year after the pandemic. And the excitement of people working so hard in this field, coming together and supporting each other, learning from each other, connecting with each other. It's becoming like a 1-week community housing festival where, you know, and we're seeing that other organizations add their annual meeting or meetings of their boards of directors or their networks in that same week. So it's the CHRA Congress and much more going at the same time. And I know that everybody out there is going to want to be the heart of this. There are still some spaces left. Go to our website, chra-achru.ca, and you can find the Congress page and register there.
You're working with a wonderful team there, Ray, doing great stuff. And as someone who attended Winnipeg last year, what a great week of learning, connecting. And, you know, if you're feeling, like I was talking about, a little bit of burnout, or you're feeling that we're not moving that needle, you never leave the you leave the conference with brimming with confidence and passion and reignited because you're around some brilliant, brilliant people. And Ray will be there too. So go to the website, sign up, lots of spots available. And Ray, thank you for the advice. Ray told me that for the eclipse that not to wear any eyewear and to stare directly into the sun. That was it, right?
That's perfect. Exactly it.
Well, listen, it has been just a pleasure having both of you on. I love this idea. It is so long coming together, you know, proof of concept, four partners coming together. I think this is really exciting. And, you know, listen, people, take a listen. Go to the website. Sign on. The more people we get on board with this, the more pressure we can put to have this become a reality. Ray, Katie, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedules and joining us on the podcast this week. So grateful.
Thank you, Michael. Canadian Housing AF.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com. And listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com. Produced by Cryer Media and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.